This version of the podcast is mixed in mono, but if you would like to listen in 5.1 surround sound, please visit ufocast.co.uk/prisoner for more details. This is episode 11, but we recorded it 14th back in September 2022.
And welcome to, well, by hook or by crook, the UFOcast does the prisoner. This is episode, help me out, look.
11.
It is 11, yes. Right, which means the DVD order and the Blu-ray order are in sync, apparently.
In this instance, yes. I mean, I think they largely right, are, okay. But...
Right, so I'm Michael, you know, because you've subscribed to our podcast. My co-host, as always, is...
Is me, I'm Luke, hello.
Hello, and this week we've got a number three. Who is our number three, Luke? It's always a surprise.
Well, it's Cliff. Hello, Cliff. Welcome to By Hook or By Crook.
Hello. Thank you very much indeed for having me.
Oh, so this time, we'll be talking about It's Your Funeral. Now, let me see. We always seem to start this in a sort of fairly standard way. So let's start off by going, hello, and why do you like The Prisoner?
Well, I remember in the early 90s when there were repeats of lots of ITC and Gerry Anderson shows and all sorts of things. And like sort of Doctor Who has always been my primary touch base for everything, and then everything spun out of that. So I would learn about all these other shows when people would make lots of references to them in Doctor Who magazine and magazines in general when I'd sort of read about them. And so, The Prisoner I was always very excited about because... you know, there was people talked about it very fondly. You know, there were articles in things like TV Zone and stuff like that that sort of made it look really amazing. And then it came on, and I think it was most of the stuff was on BBC Two, and I think it was on Channel 4 when they did the 90s repeat run, if I remember correctly. Mm. So it kind of had ad breaks and things. And I think it was on a Sunday, which was never a great day in our house for various reasons. And so I saw it initially, and I didn't really get it. And I didn't really understand it. I think maybe, I don't know, I want to say I was a bit too young, but there's someone I know who was about my age who was madly obsessed with it from that point. A couple of people, actually. But yeah, it didn't quite resonate at the time, but I was always kind of kept it in the back of my mind. And then my friend, who's also the father of my godson, usually sends me a mad Christmas package every so often, every Christmas. And he got the latest, greatest Prisoner Blu-ray box set. And so he said, I'll give you the one that came before that, because it still looks really nice and it's really good. And I thought, yeah, it's well beyond time I revisit this again. This was only last Christmas. And I just binged it insanely. It was one of those things where it's like, okay, partner goes to bed and I'll watch one episode of something and I'm still there at 3 a.m. I think partly the restoration looks absolutely beautiful. So it's filmed incredibly well. I think it's, you know, the amount of work and thought that's gone into it, I think it stands up extremely well. You know, lots of stuff was good around that time, but I think it's a cut above there. And I think the themes of it, of surveillance and general confusion and, you know, the sort of people being put through the mill by people who aren't necessarily completely in control themselves, it's still ridiculously topical 55 years later. I thought the standard of acting was fantastic. McGoohan, you know, for all, obviously he wasn't particularly easy to work with in general. It just looks stunning. So yeah, I've sort of known it all my life, but I sort of am a fairly recent convert to kind of suddenly an overnight, God, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. So yeah.
Is there a particular theme that resonates with you in watching the show?
Yeah. I really like how it's ambiguous. But at the same time, if you start to formulate theories in your mind and then it can make just enough sense for your theory. And of course, lots of other people have lots of very different theories and it makes just enough sense. So it's kind of an endless talking point of everyone goes, well, I think this is exactly what's happening. And people could make a really good case for that and still be kind of completely wrong. And it's a really nice example of how you have authorial intent, whatever was going on in Patrick McGoohan's mind, but then it's sort of a thing that's been given to the public in such a complete way that you can kind of take ownership of it, and in a way, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That sounds a bit...
Yeah, oh yeah, without question.
I think one of the things doing this podcast has made me realise is just how differently people view the show.
You've always had that argument with Doctor Who fans, especially, where it's like, if you get 20 Doctor Who fans in a room, you'll get 20 different opinions.
Yeah.
But with this show, you've not just got opinions, you've got completely new takes from almost everyone. And probably more than the 20, because you've got somebody going, well, like me going, yeah, it makes complete sense as a spy thing, but it's not. It's an allegory. No, it's a metaphor. And even in your own head, it's all of these things at once. And yet, it's just 17 episodes of a spy drama on TV, but it's so much more.
Yeah.
Well, so, right. One of the questions that we always ask is, why this episode? Why this one?
I did get a choice of a few. I didn't get a choice of all of the episodes. I think I really enjoyed it at the time. I love the montage of the prisoner's day and the sort of the usage of the observation in it. Obviously all of it's about observation and tracking and kind of things, but I think it stands out in that way. As a Doctor Who fan myself, I'm particularly delighted by the fact that for no readily apparent reason, three of the cast members were in Marco Polo, even though it doesn't share a director or any kind of reason. Oh. So you start to think, did one of them recommend Darren Nesbitt recommend Mark Eden or Mark Miller or something like that? Was that some weird thing going on? I think the first big series from that whole BBC Two repeat, so I really loved Randall and Hopkirk Deceased when they repeated that around 93. And Annette Andre is great in it. She's absolutely fantastic. I think she's great. I like how number two is very different than the Darren Nesbitt number two. It's a bit of a twist on the normal kind of situation. You've got four number twos in it.
The Morbius Doctor Who. Morbius number twos.
So just to back up on that, because we are recording this towards the tail end of recording, and most, as you said, most of the episodes had been assigned by the time you came to kind of look at the list of what we had left. If you'd had a completely free choice from all 17 episodes of The Prisoner, what would you have gone for?
Now I'm going to show my ignorance slightly. I don't have all of the titles burned in my brain because I'm, I'd say, a relatively recent...
Do it like Friends.
Oh,
like
good.
One with, yeah.
So the one with the cowboys.
We'll fill in the gap, yeah.
Okay, so the one where he goes away on the boat for a bit is really awesome, and I feel really guilty that I can't actually remember what it's called. But I really like the one where he goes away on the boat. And the body swap one, I really, really enjoyed as well. But of course, Arrival is a fantastic beginning and Fallout is a great ending. I think it's very rare that I watch a series and kind of like all of the episodes. I can be quite a sort of critical and picky and kind of, you know, internet forum, let's rank the episodes kind of person. I am that sort of person. The Prisoner is one of the very rare series where I've really enjoyed pretty much every episode for one reason or the other.
Wow. That's interesting. Because I think I certainly have my favourites and ones that I like less.
I mean, I told my friend Pete that I was doing this, who's a massive Prisoner fan, you know, the guy who gave me the box set and who I believe is coming on later.
In the series, yeah.
Yeah, I said, I'm doing It's Your Funeral. And he says, I don't like the number two in that. He's not a fan of Darren Nesbitt's number two. And I completely see why, because he's so different. I know it's not necessarily everybody's favourite episode, but yeah, I found a lot to enjoy in it.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, coming to this one, it's interesting because you said you also like the Body Swap one, which is Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, which we recorded way back at the beginning of this whole thing with my dad. And I'm not massively connected to Prisoner fandom, but it's one of the things I've picked up over the years is that It's Your Funeral and Do Not Forsake Me tend to be at the bottom of most fans' lists for one reason or another. So it's great that we've got you on to talk about this as someone who loves it. And it's an episode that I enjoy. What did you make of it, Michael?
I really enjoyed it. I've avoided forums and that kind of thing because over the years you sort of go, hang on, can I make my own mind up? Oh, go on then. And you do. And I actually enjoyed it a lot more than the one we reviewed last, which you can make up your own mind if you're listening to this in any order. But I liked it's kind of thin on the ground on the sci-fi front, which means that it's thin on the ground in the surreal aspects. But what it has got is it's a good spy storyline, but it's still got the allegories for modern living and manipulation and black flag stuff. And I apparently at the time the cast had no idea what was going on in the storyline, but it's really accessible now as a story. You're like, right, he's being manipulated into this, but they're also manipulating something on extra levels, and the new number two is also trying to prove what a great manager he is of people, that he's hired the right people to do the jobs that he needs to be done. And that's something you just didn't see in 60s drama. It's something you'll see now in a plethora of TV shows. You'll see people who can manipulate other people into doing stuff for them, and it's a very clever thing. But here, you just didn't get this on TV. Mm-hmm. It's very, very well structured. Yes, it's slow. You can, if you were so inclined, watch it at 1.5 speed and still manage to catch the entire narrative and not miss a thing. There's an unrealistic grassy knoll fight sequence. All of those things are in there. I'll put my hands up. And it's got the ridiculous... Sorry, it's still a kid's bouncy castle zone to me, that game, with the hats, right? Whatever.
Kosho.
Kosho? Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sure we'll cover in a minute.
I did feel that the stuntmen in this episode were particularly on show. You also have a very obvious shot of number 14 from Hammer into Anvil when they last played Kosho in the midst of the Kosho game. So you were like, hang on, who's he actually fighting?
The montage and the prediction of his day and the fact that the computers used quantum mechanics to figure out this old lady likes sweets.
Yeah.
So that he'll be, as soon as some person passes out, they go from threat to damsel in distress. And because of the way he's wired, he has to then protect her and do the stuff and make... So the prediction aspect is very now, you know, we just call them algorithms, but they do, oh, the computer predicted. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes a lot more sense to us from 2022 on the 55th anniversary of Arrival to the day almost, and so much time has passed and it still speaks to us. The thing that threw me when I was watching it was Mark Eden's, not just Mark Eden's pink jacket, fair enough, because most people would have seen it in black and white. Why was it pink? Don't know. There's clearly a relationship between him and number two, but that's beside the point. What is it? There's no reason that number six should suspect him, apart from him passing him, leaving number two's dome. Because he never sees him at any point, although he's the one orchestrating one level of the threat. He's convincing the jammers. Oh my God, what a good idea, plot-wise, is the jammers. It's so clever. It's very village.
A lot to unpack there, Cliff.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I do ramble. That's cool. I completely agree. I mean, I can be very, very critical of the TV that I'm involved with and watch, but I generally sort of try and have a bit of a karmic approach where basically if I'm really enjoying stuff and it has a lot of stuff in the pro column, then I'm kind of less forgiving of the little weird stuff, you know, like the shots from the other episode and slight sort of the plot things. I think... In general, a lot of the stuff in The Prisoner, you kind of, it's almost like the whole surveillance thing almost comes with like an unreliable narrator element as well, I think, especially in Fallout. So it's there's kind of things where sometimes I'm just kind of looking at the lush cinematography, I suppose, television, but I want to say cinematography. There's something about the way Mark Eden carries himself generally, not just the pink jacket, I think. I mean, he's almost like he's there to draw attention and then like double bluff, triple bluff, quadruple bluff, quintuple quadrilogy bluff. So I kind of let that slide, I suppose, a little bit. You know, he's not really been noticed before, and then suddenly he's swanning around in his pink jacket. I was like, oh, catches your eye. Did Annette Andre, Watchmaker's daughter, did she say anything about him? Is there a conversation there? There's a lot going on. I mean, I think the
Sorry, you just twigged something in my head. Do we ever see any other families or people in relationships who've arrived in the village together elsewhere? Because it's the watchmaker and his daughter.
Yes.
They are clearly, they're actually related, but they're both numbers and they're both in the village. Now, it implies that he was a terrorist, but he's also saying, I've done nothing. So he was something in a former life and a watchmaker. And he's there, but do you think it was a sort of father-daughter spy thing, or because does the village just contain spies, or does it contain just people of interest?
I mean, one of the themes of the episode is kind of like, oh, if the assassination is successful, then everyone in the village is punished. Maybe it's a case that one of them did something bad, and part of the punishment is the other one goes in. So she did something bad, and she has to take her father with her, or he did something terrible and he has to take the daughter with him as well. Maybe it's something like that.
Yeah, I can see that.
But that idea occurs to number six independently, doesn't it? I think because it's interesting because a lot of The Prisoner is about his personal fight against the system. And he can be quite disparaging of other people in the village, you know, like calling them cabbages and stuff like this. And so this is an interesting episode from that perspective, because he's actually motivated by concern for his fellow prisoners. It's not the only episode where that's the case, but I just thought that is an interesting perspective that he has, that he does underneath that kind of hard exterior, he does care about what's going on around him. He does have I suppose the reason he's there, well, we don't know the reason he's there, do we? Because he never does reveal why he resigned, but you do feel that there's like an element of conscience, perhaps, that he's there because he resigned on some kind of principle. The thing about the plot that I've never quite understood, and maybe they just needed an extra line of dialogue, is it's a bomb, right? And they're all standing very close together, and you're like, well, if that goes off, yeah, it's going to kill number two, but surely it's going to, unless it's kind of, it just needs a line of dialogue saying it's a very close-shaped charge that will just kill the person next, you know, that always just feel like, pun intended, the one hole
I can see your point,
in the plot.
Because it's even plastic explosives.
It's plastic explosives, you kind of think, that's going to pack quite a punch.
Yeah.
I think it's that weird thing of basically everybody knows, but no one can talk to each other about it. So they've all got to kind of brazen it out, because they'll all look horrifically suspicious if they back off. And they'll all blame each other, and reprisals.
You also... Division Q, apparently, are the ones trying to orchestrate the death of the old number two.
Yeah.
The old number two who we've never seen before. Right. who's going to retire at the special unveiling of the lump of rock.
Yeah.
Which is, as a piece of art, is so good. Right. But so you've never seen the number two, and he's quite clearly going to... But he's the one doing the voiceover at the beginning, going, I am number two. Or is he?
Well, the voiceover at the beginning is the bog standard Robert Riety narration.
Right.
So it's not anybody. It's not either of them.
So
basically.
So the what's the hang on, I've got him here. Andre Van Geisingham.
Who right, now
who sounds a lot like Valentine Dahl.
Oh, see, now that wasn't where I went with him. I basically spent the whole time going, who does this guy remind me of? It reminds me of Emperor Palpatine.
Because
I was like, why does this guy's voice sound familiar? And I was like, it's because he sounds like Palpatine. Because I've looked up his cast list. I must do this every time I watch the episode and go, where do I know him from? Where do I know him from? And I'm like, literally nothing other than this. But I think it suddenly occurs to me. I was like, I think that's what I'm thinking of. But yeah, I can see Valentine Dahl as well. Yeah.
Well, no, it was more the voice. I was actually thinking, has he been dubbed in that kind of Gerry Anderson way that we got so used to when there was entire characters who had somebody else's voice in the live action series? So. That was weird. Nesbitt is great. He does look... I don't know why he's wearing Joe 90s glasses, but I don't... The performance, like you said, is just exquisite.
He's not wearing Joe 90s glasses.
No, he's not.
Because Joe 90 was in production and hadn't broadcast at this point.
Fair enough. He's wearing classic big thick glasses with a radio, because the camera zooms in to show you the receiver. Yeah, everything is very on the nail with this one. It's like, is this potentially a bomb? Yes. Is this? It's all very laid out. This maybe it's the interpretation's what's missing, and that's why people don't like this episode, because it's not as vague as some of the other stuff. It's like, ready camera one, ready camera two, and you're like, hang on, you're telling me that there's not always people watching on cameras already, and they get more cameras out. Is the sound recording? The sound's always recording. But guess in number two's room, it's not.
Yeah, it kind of works for both sort of politics and for media and filmmaking and stuff in general. It's that kind of archetype stereotype of the young, posh, good-looking lad who's had everything handed onto him in a plate. And his entire shtick is basically, I'm going to look confident and just kind of do this. And sort of seeing him unravel a little bit is quite pleasurable in a number of ways, really. I mean, I've worked with people like that in offices in my office days before I ran away to join the circus, and I'm going to blag this out, I'm going to brazen this out, I thought it was really good.
I suppose the thing is that. Aside from the moment where he gets taken down a peg or two, when the computer prediction proves to be right and he's like, no, number six never buys sweets. But aside from that point, it isn't until the very end where it does all come unstuck for him. Like, the episode largely poodles along going, okay, number two's plan is working. It's working. It's working. Number six is falling into the trap. What's going to happen? And it is only at the very end, and that's one of the things I love about Darren Nesbitt's performance, is that you start to see it unravel when he's having the conversation over the, and he's obviously had to kind of stay stock still because he's not supposed to be kind of having this conversation, and then there's that moment where he comes face to face with McGoohan, and McGoohan's shaking his hand to stop him leaving, and there's just a change in his face. And it's in profile as well. It's not even like straight on, and it's not close up. It's just there's just a change in his demeanor, just in his face, that says, "Oh crap," and I'm angry now because he's obviously been playing it light for the whole episode. Is that he's having a whale of a time? It's he's in control. Like he has this disagreement with the supervisor, when the supervisor kind of leaves the door open, all that kind of stuff. He's been in control, and then suddenly the mask slips and there's the real guy underneath.
That control bit at the beginning.
Angry that he's lost control.
That control bit at the beginning is just the best bit of exposition hidden in plain sight that I've seen. It's like, I'm going to tell you what's wrong with what's happened by explaining the whole plot to the audience while I'm talking to you. It was like Keith Ford level telling off. It was so good. And it was like, I watched it and I was like, oh my God, that's so well crafted as a piece of writing. It's like, I now know what's happening. I now have got everybody's place in this. I now know what the plot is. Mm. And I've seen some drama happen. It was beautifully crafted. I was very impressed.
Can we just talk about the parallel with UFO?
Go for it.
Cliff, I mean, I don't. Do you know UFO at all, Cliff?
Yeah. I've been watching a bit of it recently again. Fun.
So we've already talked. We've alluded, and we'll get to this in proper detail when we get to spot the Doctor Who actor at the end. We've alluded to the fact that this is a Doctor Who reunion for several actors. It's also a UFO precursor because Darren Nesbitt and Wanda Ventham would feature heavily in the latter half of UFO, but they had an episode together, which I think I remember when we talked about it, Michael. I disliked the episode because Darren Nesbitt is so awful. I mean, it's a brilliant performance, but he's so creepy and awful that I'm like, I really don't like the episode. So it's nice to see them together in this, but also in the context of the computer prediction, because that's very UFO.
Yeah,
that's very UFO, and the thing of like Straker always relying on the computer prediction, and then his subordinates kind of sometimes challenging him on that. And like you said, I was, as you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that when I first watched that UFO, and when I first watched this episode, the idea of a computer being that accurate just felt absolutely preposterous.
Yeah.
It felt very silly. You were like, well, of course this is the thing of sci-fi. And yet, as you talked about earlier, like, we live in a world where algorithms can predict things about us that we wouldn't like them to have figured out, you know?
No. Yeah, you're very right.
I mean, Wanda Ventham is fab, and like the fact that she is one of the few people who kind of stand up to number two and not be browbeaten by him. Even though, yeah, she works for the village, so she's a villain, but hey, let's kind of gloss over that fact, because she's great.
What you were just saying a few minutes ago is I've just put two things in my head. Lately we've been watching, because I'm very late to the party, The American Office. We watched an episode by accident and we went, it's a lot better than the UK one, I'll watch that. And I've really liked it. So I was thinking, I just wanted to put two and two together. Let's have the village, the staff behind the scenes, the ones in the computer rooms and all that, in the bureaucracy of the village, in a little documentary, just about them, just in the kind of the office kind of, you know, because number two, like you said, is often Michael Scott. You know, he's just someone who is completely out of his depth. He's been promoted above his station and is often, well, is mostly a man, and is his own worst enemy. So it's, the prisoner is the office. Probably not, but yeah.
As we said, there are many yes. ways of reading.
Yes, that's true. So let me see. One of the ideas that occurred to me while I was watching this as well was something I mentioned a few episodes ago, which was that the message was the medium. And in this, number six becomes literally the medium for the message that they've created. But they are actually planning a bombing, but they're trying to discredit number two. The more you think about it, it's like, so do they want to kill the old number two? And is that the entire retirement plan for everyone in the village? Because I can see that being a bad thing, because no one's going to want the job if that's how you leave the job, by just getting blown up. And also McGowan doesn't get in the helicopter with him. Are you leaving? Yes. Here's a bomb and you can like leave yourself. And he saves number two. Admittedly, a number two we've never seen before, but he saves that person. Lets them fly off into the sunset until he gets caught. But number six doesn't go with him. But it doesn't really fit that he would want to. I just don't know. But
Even occurred to me that, like, that would...
No.
I suppose the implication is that it relies on him stopping Darren Nesbitt's number two from doing anything. Like, he has to make sure that the chain stays around his neck for the duration of the flight out, right?
Good call. Yeah, no, that makes a lot more sense than my... Oh, that was his opportunity. No, it wasn't.
Yeah, because this episode is not at all focused on number six trying to escape.
No, that is very true.
Just to go back to your point about, like, the cameras and the audio, and this number six very early on in this episode does that thing. Well, they're always listening, and he does that thing where he deliberately raises his voice to talk to the people in the walls who are listening.
Yeah.
And yet there are plenty of prisoner episodes which rely on the fact that there are places in the village that he can go where he's not being seen or heard. Or there are points where they're, like, deliberately turning on the audio to listen to him. It's not like there's a sort of passive system that's constantly on for any... And then there are other
episodes
which...
Well,
he doesn't know this. And then there are other episodes which imply that he is under total surveillance at every move.
Yeah.
Regardless of what the technology appears to be doing. So I think looking at it from the Doyleist perspective, there's an element of just going... The surveillance is what the plot requires it to be on any given episode, and that thinking about it too much is probably not the best way to appreciate the story. But then we overthink these things all the time, don't we?
I mean, to
it's
be
what
fair,
we're for.
Every few months or year or so, I say to my partner, it's like, should we get an Alexa? Because it might be fun. And then we have the whole kind of conversation about, you know, the Putin will hear us poo. And it's the whole Alexa argument is the same thing. It's both of those arguments, is it? I think that you just laid out. It's kind of like, maybe Alexa is like that. Maybe Alexa is like the other way. Maybe, you know, it can be both.
Yeah.
Selective.
Yeah. I can see. No. Yeah. We've got a built into our TV and I've turned it off.
It's the not knowing that drives the paranoia and the behaviour of the people who may or may not be under surveillance, right?
You're completely right. I'm convinced that this little black thing in my hand, my phone, is listening to me all the time. I've turned off every setting I can find, but I'm convinced that when you visit the Google search, all of a sudden, some of the things you were discussing earlier in the day are there on the suggestions. And you're like, but I didn't even type that in. How do you know?
Yeah.
So, but that's just perfectly an ordinary paranoia, as Slotty Bartfoss would
Everybody
say.
In the universe has that.
Everyone in the universe has that. So, while we're here, shall we get, not the elephant in the room, but the Kosho in the room out of the way, right? What's it all about? Where does the sport come from? McGowan invented it? Was he off his face? What's going on? It's trampets. It's wearing trench coats. I know he had to do his sport recreation so that they could swap the watches.
Which
I've got issues with myself, but that's just because I know my wristwatches that I wear every day. I know each individual scratch or whatever. And if someone swapped my skeleton fossil watch out for another one, I'm pretty sure I'd spot it and go, what's going on here? Especially if you're in the village and you're just naturally paranoid.
Yeah, that's one of those moments in the episode where I'm just like, no. Like, I would like just the wearing of the leather, like you say, the scratches on the you would know it wasn't your watch.
Yeah.
Unless they'd gone to a great deal of trouble to replicate it, in which case they would have to, like, at some other point study your watch, you know.
True. Which they might have done, because they do knock him out.
Well, yeah,
so they might have knocked him out the night before, got his watch, copied it to the repair room, the village's version of that with J Blades. It's all sorting that one out. and then
but yeah, Cliff, what do you make of Kosho?
I did judo for a bit when I was 10. I didn't get very far. I only got to a yellow belt. It's kind of like, I suppose it's a bit like doing judo while you're in a Zorb ball or something. kind of sci-fi fantasy martial art. I can kind of see where they've sort of taken like a boxer's protective headgear and then how could we take that to the next level? and then combine it with something that's not boxing but is also fighting. So it's kind of my brain didn't freak out when I saw it. I think the sequence in Hammer and the Anvil does go on a little bit too long. and I like the fact that there's more going on in this episode that's not that.
I suppose in terms of like what's going on plot wise in Hammer and the Anvil, he's having a fight with somebody who hates him.
Yeah,
like there's a sort of relationship there that goes throughout the episode. Whereas in this episode, it's just like we said, it's a reason. He's got to be doing something so they can switch his watch, and there just doesn't seem to be the stakes there are. But it gives you a chance to kind of watch it and go, okay, well, what are the rules of this game? I don't know. Did we figure out what's allowed, what's not allowed? Does every game finish by chucking the person into the water? Is that how you win, or are there other ways to score points? I mean,
no, it's the prisoner equivalent of Quidditch. It's a game where you watch it and you go, yes, they're clearly involved in a sport they find exciting, until you start thinking about it and going, well, hang on, if you score by doing this, but you can finish the game by doing that, surely you do this first, and doing that doesn't matter. And what was J.K. Rowling thinking? That kind of thing.
But that didn't stop people going, let's
invent it.
We can't actually fly on brooms, but let's make this into an actual sport.
Yeah.
You know, and like there are, well, I mean, obviously they're trying to change its name because of other reasons.
That's a whole different discussion.
That's a whole different podcast. Clearly, prisoner fandom hasn't gone. I mean, unless, I don't know, anybody aware of the fact? Anybody aware of Kosho at actual prisoner conventions? I don't know. Has anybody tried to play Kosho outside of the prisoner? I don't know. Write in if you know.
I was about to ask that. That would be hilarious.
That's a YouTube channel.
I'd have a game. Every convention. It's a bit like Go Johnny Go 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 in League of Gentlemen, isn't it? All those sort of games.
Can I also point out, given the average age of the prisoner fandom out there, we'd all break bones.
Be a lot of heart attacks at the prisoner convention.
I'm going to bounce. Oh, he's gone through the mat again. Okay. So we're agreed. It's just used here as a plot device. They needed to distract him, and. Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
But equally you could have done any number of things. And they'd clearly like, well, we invented this for like production order. I need to check the production order as to which of the two was made first. I think
this
it makes sense that.
Oh, I've got them written down somewhere. No, I haven't got them in this notebook. They're in my other one. It's fine.
But also the beauty of having a made up sport like that is you wouldn't get any like karate or judo or jiu-jitsu experts writing in and say, actually that move wouldn't have been possible and you would have been able to get out of it by doing this move. So if you make up your martial art, you kind of nix that.
That's nice. Clever. I hadn't thought of that. Because there's also a bit where they're both on the same trampoline and they have a swing at each other. You're like, oh, is there some boxing involved in this as well? I mean...
And there's a lot of bowing, like, and then little bows at the end, which implies it's more Japanese than Chinese.
Yeah.
And seriously, we're overthinking it. Well, I think we're giving it more thought than they did in the actual writing process.
That's what podcasts are for.
That is definitively why we're here.
How do we... I mean, so we talked a bit about how it looks... and I'm going to be repeating myself. When I was a kid watching this, I just didn't notice how many episodes were not actually shot at Port Merion.
Yeah.
You know, and again, that was because I was watching initially on VHS and then DVD. And it's through watching the Blu-ray that you kind of see that's at Port Merion, that's a set, that's at Port Merion, that's a set. how did we feel that this episode fared in that regard?
I've got no issues because although they're sets, they're external sets, quite a lot of them, and they're still shot outside. And I've never had an issue with it at all because it all joins up. Mm. The only thing I've ever really had an issue with is actually at Port Merion, which is the use of the hospital because it's so out of the same design as everything else because it's on the hill round the back and is the cafe now and near the car park. So you... It is actually at Port Mirian, but it just doesn't look like the rest of the village.
Yeah.
But that's the only thing I've ever really had an issue with. But I know a lot of it is filmed. It's the Norwegian village at MGM, I think it was, that they used bits of. But I haven't got no problem. I did have a bit of an issue with the like I said, the unrealistic grassy knoll where they have a bit of a punch up, because it looks like it's not even green, real grass. It looks very fake. And it looks like they haven't exactly let themselves down, but it's like, oh, you normally do better than that, guys, I guess.
And I think the kind of the nature of the whole series kind of has that built-in insurance policy of, if it looks a bit fake, well, you're in a very fake artificial village, and that's its kind of get-out-of-jail-free card in a way, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I know what you mean. But, I mean, certainly for me... you know, when you sort of grow up sort of watching a lot of Doctor Who, when you get that film, video
oh, yeah.
set, and, the,
yeah,
and
yeah.
even when yeah. they when they mix in Ealing stuff, so you get like location film, Ealing film, outside stuff. I it didn't really register with me. Again, you know, I think that's partially because, you know, the Blu-rays that we're watching have been very beautifully graded and restored. Mm-hmm. And, you know, grading will be in people's mind, you know, they'll kind of match all that up. You know, it's very well lit, and mm-hmm. not everything is, you know, consistently lit between different kind of shooting styles as well.
Yeah.
And again, it's that kind of, you know, the column A, column B, the pros and negatives things. It's like I'm involved enough in the story because the performances are so good and the dialogue is so interesting and kind of sparse, but just sparse enough. And, you know, it tells you enough to keep you interested without sort of being too baffling and ridiculous, and it doesn't spoon feed the exposition. So I kind of think I sort of my brain is following two or three of the threads and kind of letting the other one slide, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's a criticism. It's just something that I've noticed this time round more so than before.
Oh, no, yeah.
In the same way that I suppose, like you say, I probably didn't. It certainly didn't have a name for what was going on with the film videotape way that the BBC used to make.
It was 16mm, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, the BBC did 16mm and videotape, whereas this is all 35mm. Because Lou Grade had the money or whatever.
yeah, fair enough.
And I mean, it does make you think, like, what would BBC shows have looked like if they'd had the... if they'd had the budget to kind of shoot them this way. But that's a whole different kind of...
Yeah, but 35mm cameras are very big. And 16mm, you've got your Bolex and things like that. They're portable, you can move them around. I can see why the BBC went that way.
Yeah.
But like you said, when we're growing up, you're just going, oh, that footage is... Ooh, where are we? Oh, we're definitely in a studio. We're definitely outside. Yeah. We're definitely in a studio. But there's we know from experience from Doctor Who there's exceptions to that. There's stuff where what's it called? It's
Talons
a jungle planet.
Video.
No, I was thinking the jungle planet where
Planet of Evil.
Planet of Evil.
When they're wandering around and you're like, this would look terrible on video.
And then they show it on video.
And then they show it on video and you go, this looks terrible on video.
Yeah.
I think Face of Evil does that a bit as well.
Yeah.
Both jungle.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's when you have the, and then the web planet. It's got some great stuff with them flying around in Ealing, and then the studio stuff is a bit questionable. Well, you tell me, Michael, because I think Cliff is all over this.
No, Cliff is definitely all over this.
So can you tell me who you spotted and what they were in Doctor Who, if you spotted anybody?
Mark Eden is Marco Polo.
Well done.
There we are. And apparently, according to Cliff, other people were in Marco Polo.
Yes. Yeah. Do you know either of them?
I did. It was in my head, but I was so happy that I'd got Mark Eden. I was just kind of, I'm done here. It's fine. And of course, my brain went, Wanda Ventham, got you, but you're not. Oh.
So, yeah, no, I mean, Wanda Ventham was in Doctor Who three times, so you score points for her. So.
Okay, right. Well, let's go for... I'll do me Mark Eden and my Wanda Ventham, and then I'm going to bow to your superior knowledge, Cliff, and off you go.
Go ahead, take us through everybody else, Cliff.
So, yes, so Darren Nesbitt was Tigana in Marco Polo, and Mark Miller was Kublai Khan, mighty Kublai Khan, also in Marco Polo. And I just find it extraordinarily exciting that three guest characters were all guest characters in the same Doctor Who, because this is very common to see lots of other people. But Michael Billington's in it as well.
Tell us about him.
Michael Billington. Or am I confusing him with Michael Bilton? Maybe that's sometimes Billington.
You're not alone.
No, you're not. So I had to look this up because I was like, who's my... So Michael Bilton, who in Michael It's Bilton, Your Funeral
yes.
is the MC
yes,
counsellor. So I don't know... I don't even know which character the MC counsellor was, but so it's clearly a reasonably minor part in this episode. But as far as Doctor Who...
One who introduces the outgoing numbers, he's like the master of ceremonies.
Oh, him! Yeah. Right, yeah. So him appeared in Doctor Who three times as Charles de Teligny in The Massacre.
Right.
So entirely missing from the archives. He was Collins, so the manservant who gets killed. Well, everybody gets killed by mummies in Pyramids of Mars. And he was a Time Lord in The Deadly Assassin Part 1. So, again, quite a small role from him. We've done Wanda Ventham three times, Doctor Who. Did you spot any other Doctor Who connections? Because I spotted one this time round that I'd not seen before.
No, I did not.
Did either of you recognise the painter?
Oh, the one who tells him what's going on.
Yes, and then shows him the very abstract painting that he's been painting.
Yeah, I did not recognise
him. Did he look familiar to you?
I looked him up. He's the dad of someone very famous who was in Doctor Who.
Yes, and according to IMDb, that person was an extra in this episode. So the painter was Charles Lloyd Pack. Father of because I was like, his face looks familiar. I was like, why does his face look familiar? And then when I saw who he was, I was like, of course, he's Roger Lloyd Pack's father.
Trigger.
And according to IMDb, at the very least, in the list of uncredited people, you have Roger Lloyd Pack as a villager. And he would have been in his 20s at the time. So it's conceivable that given his dad had a speaking role in it, that he would have been.
So the
set.
The bloke who Mr. Cyberman builder.
Mr. Cyber Cyberman, yes. Yeah.
Skin is of metal. The body that will never age.
Yeah.
Or die.
Like one of the hammiest performances in Doctor Who ever, which I remember.
I think one of the hammiest performances he's ever did.
Well, yes.
He was renowned amongst the acting community as being just an actor's actor. People were just like, no, he really is very good. He once came to the theatre when I was working Theatre Royal, and all of the other actors were kind of in hushed tones around him, and I'm thinking, my brain was just going, Buttigieg, Trigger. Surely, and then you realise, oh no, he's a ridiculously refined actor. It's like some serious, like Shakespeare level people were like, whoa, we're in the same room as him.
Yeah,
and you were like, okay, so I really had to not up my game, but go, right, clearly they know more than me what's going on. And you look into it and you discover what a ridiculously good actor he was.
Yeah. But he will be forever remembered for Any Fools and Horses.
Yeah.
There's no two bones about that.
So. True.
But yes, I had not noticed that before. And then, I mean, there's quite a lot of people on the uncredited list for this episode, because it's one of those ones where you have village crowd scenes. So there's clearly loads of people that... So next time I watch it, I'll be like, right, can I spot him in the crowd at any point? And what did he look like as a 20-something?
True.
No.
Well, I think we've done particularly well talking about this episode, because it's a great episode, but I can see, you know what? Anyone who doesn't think it's a good episode of The Prisoner, they can just go away. They're wrong.
Yeah.
It makes more sense. The ending makes more sense than the last one we talked about, and I just loved it.
I very much enjoyed it too. Cliff, where can people find you online? Or where might they have heard you, I think, is probably the question to ask.
Well, if you're a fan of Warhammer audio dramas, I'm in about 20-odd of those through Games Workshop Warhammer. I've done, for Audible, I play completely unrecognisably. I'm in Alien 3, the William Gibson script, directed by Dirk Maggs. I play Dissolis. And in
Do you get killed horribly by a xenomorph?
Yes, but I last a little bit longer than some of the others, so I get to run around screaming slightly longer, spoilers, which is great. And also, I play Garrison in episode 17 of The Audible Sandman, which is very exciting. Sandman Series 3 has just come out, which I'm not in, but hopefully everyone that gets excited about Series 3 will go, oh, I haven't heard 1 and 2 yet. Go and listen to 1. And I fulfilled a lifelong ambition of getting to be in a Doctor Who audio drama back in 2019. I'm in Blood on Santa's Claw, the Big Finish Christmas special with Colin Baker. I play four characters in that. So, yeah. Oh, thank you. I absolutely love the script. And
it's the scariest version of Wind in the Willows you'll ever hear.
God, yeah. Yeah. I get killed horribly in one as well. That's my death scream is in my showreel, and I believe for good reason. So yes, I have a home studio. I'm based in Rotterdam, but I'm only an hour ahead from the UK. I can get over on a night bus pretty easily for studio. So yes, please book me. Oh, and I'm Tweetscliff on Twitter, where I bore about politics and Doctor Who and stupid jokes.
Yeah, that was where we connected, and you ended up on the podcast. So
hey, thank you very much indeed.
For joining us. Thank you for joining us, listeners, and I will see you next time.
Thank you, listeners. Farewell.
Be seeing you.